I know that all of you, of course, have memorized my books, but in the book on the Parsha, I wrote a footnote saying that at some point I'm going to come back to a particular issue regarding Nadav Avihu. So this is the point that I'm coming back to it. I'm not going to repeat everything that I said there, so if you've read it, good. If you haven't read it, also good. But I will repeat at least some things. Let's start, and you'll get the source sheets in a couple of minutes. Let's start at the beginning of the parsha. Vayehi biyom hashmini, kara Moshe la'aron ulevanav ulezeknei Yisrael. This is the eighth day. Rashi tells us it's Rosh Chodesh Nisan. There is machloket. It's the eighth day of Nisan, or the eighth day of the Miluim, the eighth day of preparations. On the eighth day, Moshe calls Aaron, Uvanav, and Zeknei Yisrael. He calls all, but then in Pasuk Bet, he speaks directly to Aaron. Vayoma el Aaron, kach lecha egel ben bakar lechatat. Bring an egel for a sin offering. Bring an egel as a chatat. And I don't think we can really make a mistake about that, because when Aaron is bringing an egel for a sin offering, and we realize his sin took place with an egel, we realize that what we have right now with the completion of the Mishkan is an attempt to bring about kapara, forgiveness, for the sin of the golden calf. That should be clear. The ayol la'olah tmimim v'hakrev l'pnei Hashem. And for an olah, which is a different kind of offering, not a sin offering, for an olah, to bring an ayil. What does an ayil remind us of? Akedat Yitzchak. An ayil is for Akedat Yitzchak, which is an offering, is a gift offering, as it were. So what we have then is fixing this incredibly terrible traumatic sin. What's the matter? You getting more? Fixing this terrible traumatic sin, Cheta Egel, but at the same time, somehow associating with this wonderful offering which Avraham gives, or is willing to give, which is represented by the ayil, which reminds us of the Akedat Yitzchak. The El B'nei Yisrael, to daber lemor, but to B'nei Yisrael, Moshe is told to tell them, or Moshe tells them, K'chu si'ir izim l'chatat. Bring a Seir Izim as a Chatat. This is obviously related to Mechirat Yosef, which means that the great sin that Aaron personally has is the Cheta Egel, that's the sin of this generation. But now we also see on this incredible day, you still don't get one, that on this, our other, should be one. Are there more photocopies or?
No, stop.
Okay. Ask somebody in the office to. You're late. Yeah. I guess, how many more do we need? Like another 10. So the great sin, which is identified with Am Yisrael, which is Mechirat Yosef, the great sin, the Cheta Egel, which means this really links together different generations, different sins. This day, where the Mishkan is going to be completed, this is going to be an incredible day. That's really what we're being told. In fact, there's a passage in the Gemara. Which says that from the day of creation, there was not such an incredible day where it caused there to be so much simcha in front of God. Let's see if I included that someplace. In source 26. For those of you who have it, v'haktiv v'yehi b'yom hashmini v'tana oto hayom simcha gdola haita l'fnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu ki yom shenavru bo shemayim v'aretz. that there was joy in front of God is as the day where heaven and earth. By the way, when it says vahaktiv, it means that there's going to be a problem, there's going to be a question. Tivhach vayhi b'yom ha'shmini k'tiv hatam vayhi er vayhi voker yom echad. Hashachiv Nadav Aviyu. Nonetheless, the Gemara notes that Nadav Aviyu died on that day, and that sort of put a damper on the party. But at least theoretically, this should have been this absolutely incredible day. And as we said, something goes wrong. Already at this point, it says, in Pasuk Bet, it says, V'hakrev l'fnei Hashem, you should offer this in front of God. In Pasuk Dalet, V'zvoach l'fnei Hashem. In Pasuk Hey, V'ichlu et asher tziva Moshe o'pnei o'amoed, V'ikru kol edav yamdu l'fnei Hashem. You can't help but notice that this l'fnei Hashem comes back again and again in this section. Maybe there's nothing which is stronger than really being in front of God, feeling that you're in front of God, feeling the proximity to God. We're skipping a little bit, going towards the end of that chapter, when everything was brought in source number 2, which is Perek Tet, Pasuk Kachbet. V'yisa Aaron et yadav el ha'am v'yivarchem v'yeyred ma'asot ha'chatat v'olav v'shlamim. He completed everything and he blesses the people. V'yavo Moshe v'Aaron el ha'omoid v'yitzu v'yivarchu et ha'am v'yeyra kavod Hashem al kol ha'am. Which means the glory of God appears in front of the entire people. V'tetzi esh milifnei Hashem. And therefore, there is a divine response. God responds to all of these offerings. And it says that a fire comes out milifnei Hashem from in front of God. V'tochal al ha'mizbeach et ha'olah ve'et ha'chalavim. And the fire comes and swallows up, encompasses the olah. V'yar kol ha'am. And all the people see this. V'yironu v'yiplu opneihem. They break out in song, in joy, rina, from the word rina, and they fall on their faces. Which means that the joy that takes place from God's perspective is felt from man's perspective as well. In your Christian Bibles, and for that matter in your Jewish Bibles, we then have a new chapter, Perek Yud. I'm not at all convinced there should be a new chapter at that point. The next pasuk, V'yichlu b'nei Aaron Nadav Aviyu ish machtato, v'yinu b'hem esh v'yisimu lef ketoret v'yakrivu lefnei Hashem, esh zara asher lo tziva otam, v'tetze esh melefnei Hashem, v'tochal otam v'yamutu lefnei Hashem. You notice over here the lefnei Hashem repeated itself. That the lefnei Hashem repeated itself another 3 times in those 2 psukim. And as far as I can tell, this lefnei Hashem is incredibly significant in terms of our understanding what took place. And then for that matter, my observation a moment ago that Perek Yud is directly a continuation of Perek Tet, that's clearly the case. That whatever just now was achieved in the end of Perek Tet, this incredible response of God, which it sounds wonderful, well, actually, we have another response of God. They bring this, they again go lefnei Hashem, and then we have a fire coming lefnei Hashem, and they die in front of God. Now, I have 2 questions, which I probably should ask them in a different order. First question is, what sin did Nadav and Aviyu commit which caused them to die? 1 second, don't answer. What sin did they do which caused them to die? And if you look in the commentaries, you'll find numerous different approaches as far as what they did. If I'm not mistaken, if you look in the Or HaChaim HaKadosh over here, and this, he goes on and on and on, he'll give you all kinds of things that they did. By the time we're finished with them, they're guilty of just about every single sin you can practically imagine. They're guilty in no particular order of bringing an offering they weren't supposed to bring, of going where they weren't supposed to go, of drinking before they went in, of being arrogant and not getting married, being single. It says that there was nobody who was good enough for them. We have a Gemara telling us that they were sitting around and talking, when are Moshe and Aaron going to die already that we can take over? And it gets worse and worse. All kinds of sins, you name it, they're accused of these terrible things. So, as I said, my first question is, which sin do they really do that are guilty? But my second question is, which I already told you should have been the first question, did they in fact sin? Is there a sin over here? And again, before you say anything else, let's just read the words again and then try to determine if there is, in fact, a sin. It says, "Vayikrivu lefnei Hashem eish zarasha lo tziva otam." That could either be an attack against them or a statement of fact. And what happens? "Vateitzei eish milefnei Hashem vatochal otam vayimutu lefnei Hashem." You know, if it only would have said vayimutu, I would have been less inclined to say what I'm about to say. Had it said, a fire comes out in front of God and they die, and they're swallowed up, that sounds quite terrible. But what exactly does it mean, vayamutu lefnei Hashem, to die in front of God? Vayamutu lefnei Hashem does not necessarily sound like... It sounds like they're a korban, but lefnei... Correct, absolutely. In fact, if you look at source number 7, this is the way that it's repeated later on in Sefer Bamidbar. By the way, you notice again this lefnei Hashem is repeated over there as well. And for that matter, I did not quote you all the places, but again in source number 8, this lefnei Hashem in their death is mentioned every single time. And therefore, I do have to go back and ask, what exactly did they do wrong? Did they do something wrong? Or what took place over here? Moshe's answer, and Rashi's understanding of Moshe's answer, only helps in our confusion, or helps to contribute to our confusion. Going back to Perek Yud, source number 3, immediately after they die, Vayoma Moshe el Aharon, Hu asher diber Hashem lemor, Bikrovai ekadesh, Vapnei kol ha'am ekaved, Vayidom Aharon. He says, this is what God had said. What does it mean, Bikrovai ekadesh? I will be sanctified by what? What does it mean, Bikrovai? By those that are close to me, or Bikrovai, those making offerings, Vapnei kol ha'am ekaved, Vayidom Aharon, and Aharon is silent. What exactly is Moshe saying to him? If you read Rashi, next source, Rashi writes, Hechon diber, where is it that God said it? V'no adati shamal v'nei Yisrael v'nekadesh bichvodi, and he quotes source number 5, V'no adati shamal v'nei Yisrael v'nekadesh bichvodi. What does Rashi say again back in source 4? Im tom bichvodi ela bimichubadai, by those who are the most honored. Omalei Moshe la'aron, Aaron achi, yodea hayiti, Shiit kadesh habayit b'miyuadav shel makom, v'yiti savor obi obecha, achshav ro'ani shehem gdolim mimeni umimcha. By the way, does Moshe understand that they sinned? They did some terrible sin over here. Does Moshe see that they were drunk, or they were arrogant, or that they weren't married, or whatever else you want to say? Or does Moshe say that, no, I always knew that that there would be a necessity, and this is very strange to us. We don't even begin to understand this. That there was a necessity, Moshe tells us, that for the Beit HaMikdash, for the Mishkan, to start off, it needed an ultimate sacrifice of a human being. I know all you're going to tell me that Jews don't like human sacrifice, and the idea of the Akedah was that we don't want such things. And you'll tell me that Easter was last week, and we don't believe in these kinds of things, of humans dying for other people's sins, and so on and so forth. How can this possibly be? So all that I'll say is go back and you figure out what Rashi means. And Rashi says it also in Shemot on that pasuk. Look, if you read the Rashi carefully, he doesn't actually say the words I'm putting in his mouth, but he gets pretty close to it. He said, "I knew." Basically, what is Moshe saying? And you can go back to the verse afterwards and figure out yourselves what Moshe is trying to say. Moshe is telling Aaron, this is the way that it had to be. Someone had to die. I thought it would be me, I thought it would be you. And turns out it was them, which means they were far greater than us. Which means Moshe doesn't understand their deaths as being something which is a result of sin, as much as some kind of result of getting close to God, and this is the price that had to be paid to become close to God. As I said, this is a very strange thing. And we read this and we don't necessarily understand what it is that we're reading. And now you go back and you look at all these times when it speaks about their death, and it says, Nadam v'yu died, l'fnei Hashem. Although it does also say, because I'm ignoring the other part of it, it says Eish Zara. So Eish Zara may be that they were not the ones who were supposed to die, but that doesn't tell you that no one was supposed to die. And that's really what Rashi is telling us.
What you're saying now, that the sacrifice of Korban, that the Esh came from Shamayim and took them?
I'm not saying that. The Chumash says that. The Chumash says that a fire came from heaven and swallowed them up, which is an exact replication of the previous verse where it says that a fire came from heaven and ate up the Ola and the Chlavim. That's what it says in the Chumash. You can't help but read Perek Tet Pasuk of Dalet, but Teitzei Eish Melefnei Hashem V'tochala Mizbeachet Ola V'tochalavim V'yar Kol Am V'yirinu V'yiplu Apneihim. And then, right afterwards, it says, V'chub Bnei Aaron Adav Aviyu Ish Machtatov Yitnu Bahem Eish V'yisimu Aleh Ketorit V'yikrivu Lefnei Hashem Eish Zara Shelo Tivautam V'teitzei Eish Melefnei Hashem V'tochalotam V'yimutu Lefnei Hashem. You can't read the continuation over here without appreciating that whatever they did somehow is some kind of a continuation. Now, let me read a midrash for you.
Yeah. Interesting that even though it's broken up here in the chapters in the Hebrew, I mean, it's not even in the lines; it's continuing.
Right. That's what I said.
Yeah. Right. No, I know you. You said it's continuing. No,
you're agreeing with me.
I'm agreeing.
Yes. You're right. No, correct. Is that sometimes you get fooled by these things?
Like, you look at the English, it looks like they're, you know, the way it's divided up, and you need to
look at source 18. Now let's look at source 19 first, then we'll go back to 18. In 19, the Magale Amukot writes, Nadav Avihu Metu B'Nishika B'Sod V'Yamutu L'Fnei Hashem. What we noticed before to die L'Fnei Hashem is that it's dying by a kiss. Dying by a kiss, according to the Gemara, is the greatest level of death. But it means it literally is that God took them back. But God took them back in the sense of an incredible, intimate description of the way that they die. Look at verse 18. In Medrash Rabbah, Arba Mekomotu Mazkir Mitatan Shabnei Aaron. If you go searching through Chumash, you'll find that on four occasions it comes back and describes their death. Umazkir Surchanan, and it says what it was that they messed up with. The Kol Kach Lama. Why does it tell you each time that it was because they brought this fire? Lodiacha Shelo Haya Avon Biyadam Elazeh. They did nothing wrong other than this. By the way, no one listens to this midrash, because what does it say? It says each time it says, why did they die? Because they brought a fire and nothing else. This is a direct result of the bringing of the fire, and don't go ahead and say they did anything else wrong. As I told you, go looking at all the commentaries, you'll find all the bad things that they did, and you'll find whole lists of them. And I mean, a matter of fact, you look in the previous paragraph in Medrash Rabbah, in source 17, here it says, why does it repeat it all these times? Because it bothered God, it hurt God, as it were. Shubinaram Chavivin, God liked them. V'cheinu Omer, Kravai Ekadesh. Hakrivam Eish Zara, Rabbi Kiva Omer Al Hakrava. Rabbi Kiva says, because they made this Hakrava. Rabbi Yossi Al Hakriva, because they went where they shouldn't have gone. You continue on later on. It says, Rabbi Yirmiya Bar Kapara, Bishim Rabbi Yirmiya, Rabbi Lezer Omer Bishvil, Arba Dever Meitu B'nei Aaron. Now we're up to four things that they died for, and it throws in a couple others, Eish Zara, and it goes on, and there's a whole list of all these things that they've done. As I said, the next paragraph it says in the Midrash, don't say for a second they did anything else which is wrong. But I also find it particularly interesting where it tells us that God found this very, very painful. Haya kasheh l'fnei hamakom. It was difficult for God. There is a parallel to this. To what I think took place over here. And in order to understand the parallel, I want to jump right into source number 40. Because this is what I wrote in the footnote that I was going to come back to, so let me come back to it before we go any further astray. Tanu Rabbanan, our rabbis taught. Those of us, when we studied Agadah a couple of years ago, we spent time on this Agadah. Arba nichnasu lepardes, there were four people who went into Pardes. Eluhin ben Azai ben Zoma va'acher v'Rabbi Akiva. This is one of the most famous passages in the Talmud that describes to us the dangers involved in Kabbalistic study. Four people go in. Rabbi Akiva gives them a very enigmatic wording. Amalam Rabbi Akiva, kishetikansu etzal evnei shayish tahor. When you go to the marble of pure stone, hizarum shalotam rumayim mayim, be careful not to say water, water. Bishum dechtiv, for it says, dover shkarim lo yikon lenegedei nai. That he who lies cannot, who speaks lies cannot exist in front of me. Ben azai hitzitz, he looked, b'mate, and he died. V'lavat katuv omer, yakar b'nei Hashem avtala chasidav. Precious in God's eyes is the death of his saints. Ben zoma hitzitz b'nifka, ben zoma looked, and he was nifka, which means he went crazy. Rashi says, v'nifka, nitrafa da'ato. Third line from the bottom of the page. Rashi says, v'nifka, v'nitrafa da'ato. He lost his mind. Alava kotevo mitvash matzata chodayeka. If you find honey, eat enough, not too much. Pentis be'enu, because if you get filled up on something which is sweet, v'haketo, and you'll end up vomiting. Acher, Elisha ben Avuya, kitzitz b'netiot, means that he became a heretic, or literally he ripped out the trees from paradise. Rabbi Akiva nichnas b'shalom v'yatza b'shalom. Only Rabbi Akiva entered and left in peace. Percentage is not that good. 3 out of 4 have terrible demises. I don't know any school would want to name themselves Pardes with this kind of a track record, where your graduates, only 1 out of 4, seem to make it unscathed. Ben Azai dies. We don't know why he dies. What are we told? Hitzitz v'met. He looked and he died. Rashi says, Hitzitz, what did he look at? Rashi says, the Tzad HaShchina. He looked at the Shechina. He looked at God's presence. I don't know how you look at God's presence. I don't know what this means. Yakor b'nei Hashem hamuvtal l'chasidav. Precious to God is the death of his saints. So does God see Ben Azai as being a positive figure or as being a terrible sinner? Which one? A sinner or as being somebody who's positive? It calls him chasidav. Rashi writes, "Huksha mitato lefanav," that God took this death very difficult, very hard for God, "lefi shemet bachur," because he died when he was very young. Which, by the way, according to Rashi and other places, is that he was never married. As Ben Zoma was not married. As were, who else? Nadav Avihu. And if you saw the Midrash a moment ago, it's the exact same language over here. Huksha mitatav lefanav. Nonetheless, e efshar shelo yamut, it was impossible that he not die. Mishum shenemar ki lo yereini haadam v'chai, for it says that man cannot see me and live. Now, even though some of you already understand the basic connection over here between the sources, whatever you understand so far, I can assure you that there's much, much more going on over here. But in order to really open up the door and to understand this properly, first let's comment on what exactly does it mean when it says that four people nichnasu lepardes. Later authorities in the last 700 years will tell you that pardes means pshat, remez, drash, and sod. As I can assure you, there's no ancient authority who says that. That is not what the Gemara thinks it means. It's not what Rashi thinks it means. It's not what Rapaigon thinks it means. It's not what the Aruch thinks that it means. Any source which is more than 700 years old does not know at all about that acronym. They actually have a very simple understanding of what Pardes is. Pardes, according to them, is Gan Eden. Very simple. Four people go into Gan Eden. And that is the reason why Gan Eden in English is called paradise. The four people go into Gan Eden, four people go into paradise, four people go into paradise. Why? Why do they go there? The answer is, and this already is based upon the Zohar, and it's based upon all kinds of Kabbalistic sources, which we will see how far we need to go today to understand this. They were trying to create some kind of a tikkun. I mean, we know that Rabbi Akiva was involved in messianic support of the Bar Kochav rebellion. He believed that Bar Kochav would be Mashiach. Mashiach, the belief in Mashiach, or the belief in the coming of Mashiach, is not just a sisma. You don't just put up yellow signs and saying that Mashiach is coming. And in order to try to bring about Mashiach, one has to do far more than that, including limud Torah, mitzvot leben adam l'chaveiro, ben adam l'makom. But aside from all of that, they also understood something else. That the ultimate goal of Mashiach is to fix the world. Tikkun olam. For the world to be fixed, you first have to realize that something is broken. What was the first thing that was broken in the world? The first thing that was broken was... The first thing that was broken was in Gan Eden. The first thing that was broken was the sin of Adam and Chava in Gan Eden. That's the first thing which is broken. Which means if we are going to somehow bring about a fixing, a situation whereby Mashiach can come, we need to go all the way back to the beginning and fix that which is broken in the beginning. In order for us to understand this even on our level, let's realize a passage in the Zohar, which I'm just going to tell you outside, we're not going to look at it inside. It tells us that, according to the Zohar, the sin of Adam and Chava was with the Eitz Hadaat, which according to the Zohar was, what kind of tree? Was grapes. In the Gemara, you have all kinds of other opinions, it's grapes. What they do, in the simplest terms, this is the way the Sfat Emet describes it, they squeeze the grapes, they make wine, and they make Kiddush Friday afternoon before Shabbos. You can't get drunk on Friday afternoon. If you get drunk on Friday afternoon, Shabbos is not going to happen. And what happens is that they get... What? That happened last week, right? Did Shabbos happen? I don't remember what happened last week. But one more minute. That the sin that takes place is using the wine too early, misusing the wine. According to the Zohar, after the world undergoes this incredible cleansing, this incredible mikvah, what am I referring to? The Mabul comes and cleans up all the sins and all the sinners. What he does, according to Zohar, is he plants a kerem. Why? Because he says, if we've already now gotten rid of all the evil, this massive mikvah has now cleansed the world, now let's go one step further back, and let's now create a tikkun for the chait of Adam and Chava, and let's go and fix the world. Of course, what happens is, instead of fixing the world, Noah gets drunk with that wine, which means that the same sin again is still there. According to the Zohar, Nadav and Avihu, on this incredible day, when we've already gotten to the point of a tikkun for the Cheta Egel, a tikkun for Mechirat Yosef, what else is left? The tikkun for the sin in the Garden of Eden, and therefore the idea that they take the wine and they go in front of God with this wine is because they are trying to fix something which is broken. They're trying to fix the sin. When you now realize this parallel of four people going into Pardes and things going terribly wrong, you have to realize that messianic expectation is not simply, you put up signs or you put up, these, you put them on your cars and drive around. It's what they are trying to do is fix what is broken. Now, this approach of Nadav and Avihu, this is not new. This we can already trace back to Har Sinai when they stood by Har Sinai. And we'll read the verse in a second. Yes.
Even before they made wine or ate the apple, the first sin and consciousness, they didn't listen to God's voice.
That is ultimately what every sin is, but it's not listening to God's voice. And what did they do? And again, the apple is only based upon sources from the Middle Ages. There's no ancient rabbinic source that says apple. It's really based upon art, and Christian art for that matter. There were no apples in the Middle East in the antiquity. No rabbi ever would have said apple because they never saw an apple. Yes?
I have long been confused, and I think there are conflicting views on this, about whether Moshiach comes when things are bad and it has to be fixed, or when we've done everything possible to fix it. And you're hinting at that same dichotomy in the way you talk about it, because you say we have to recognize the sin to bring Moshiach, but then you talk about the sacrifices and so forth as an effort to repair the sins.
I'll try to help you with this confusion. The Gemara says there's more than one end game. Either it can come this way, it can come this way. We prefer that we fix everything and then Mashiach comes, rather than simply we've run out of time and the world is in terrible shape. We're about to destroy ourselves, so then we get saved at the end. But the Gemara says clearly there is more than one way.
Is that the connection to the Davening agreement, that the become is between the Spaniards and
Abraham? Absolutely. Let's take a look at that. Yes, let's take a look at source number 11. Who, Nadav Navihu?
Yeah,
it never says that they were drinking. What happens is, the very next section, immediately after this, is that we're told that they're not supposed to... The very next thing is that God speaks to Aaron and says, do not go into the inner sanctuary or go into the sanctuary when you're drunk, and therefore you won't die. So therefore the understanding is, well, if you don't go in, you won't die, therefore maybe that's what just now happened. That's where the Midrash gets that from. Let's look at source number 11. The El Moshe Amar Alei El Hashem Atav Aaron Nadav Avihu V'shivim Izikne Yisrael V'shtachavitim Mirachok. Skipping a little bit to Pasuk Tet. Vayal Moshe v'Aaron, Nadav Aviv, v'shiv mizikne Yisrael, they went up. Vayir'u et Elokei Yisrael, they see the God of Israel, whatever that means. V'tachat raglav kimasei levnata sapir uke'etzem ha'shaim letohar. Any of you would like to translate that for me, I'd be very obliged to know what that verse means. It means that they see the God of Israel, and under the legs are like the levnata sapir. Most likely, livnat comes something to do with the stone sapir, most likely is related to sapphire. I'll just mention this, because remember when Rabbi Akiva warned them, when you do go up, make sure you don't say anything about these avnei shayish tahor, about these pure marble when you go up there. Don't say water, water. That is most likely related to this verse over here. Uke'etzem ha'shamayim l'tohar, and it's like the very essence of heaven. The tohar most likely has to do with purity. And then the next verse is, they look, and the next verse says, ve'el atzilei b'nei Yisrael, but to the princely, to the, what's the word, atzil,
noble.
Is the better word than noble? To the noble of Israel, lo shalach yado, God did not strike them. They looked at God and they ate and they drank. Which means they looked, and what was supposed to happen? They looked and they're supposed to die. What happened to Ben Azai? He looks and he dies. What does he look at? He looks at the Shekhinah. Why does he die? Because how can you look at God and not die? Right? How can you look at God and not die? Now listen to Rashi, source number 12. Vayiru et Elokei Yisrael nistaklu v'hitzitzu v'nitchayvu mita. They looked and they had to die. Ela shelo ratzah HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'arei simchat ha-Torah v'himtin l'nadav aviyu ad yom Chanukat ha-Mishkan. God didn't want to ruin simchat Torah, so therefore he waited for the day the Mishkan would be completed. By the way, that itself is interesting, because that means that this is, Rashi would therefore lead us to believe this is such a happy day, he doesn't want to ruin the happy day. So instead, what does he do? He ruins the other happy day by taking them at that point. What? This is Matan Torah. This is Matan Torah. That means that Matan Torah, at the point of revelation, there is something which is very dangerous involved in it. Namely, that these people are somehow looking at God, as I said, whatever this means, because we know you can't look at God. What is that? If I would have asked you, what does this mean? You can't look at God and live. How would you, right? Lo yirah adam v'chai. What would you have understood to mean? That you can't see God. But over here, it seems to tell us that there is something that can be seen, so the only problem is you can't live.
Why were the others?
Which others? So the thing is, it doesn't tell us who. The Zekenim, Rashi will tell us, they're going to get there soon also. Okay, something's coming to the Zekenim as well. Look, the Midrashim point out over here a parallel that exists. But not even a parallel, a contrast that exists. Moshe, when he is in front of the snare, he hides his eyes. He refuses to look. And by the way, on that point, there's our conflicting midrashim as well. Moshe refuses to look. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? On the other hand, over here, Nadav Avihu, not only do they look, but they eat and they drink. And this is what the Kabbalistic sources are referring to when it's saying that they feel, instead of hiding from God, they feel that they're going to go and they're going to look at God. Incidentally, who was the first person to hide from God? That, of course, goes back to Adam and Chava, which means that God is their manifest. You have a Gilui Shechina. You have a revelation of the Garden of Eden. What they do is they hide from God. So now over here, apparently, Nadav and Avihu are very interested in having this other kind of, you know, relation with God. It's not only, as Rashi tells us, okay, God is keeping this in mind, I'm going to get them later. Later on, they continue doing what we already see them starting over here. This is the antecedent of their behavior. They are not going to be ones to hide. They feel that one has to get closer to God and closer to God. They feel that part of the sin is the hiding from God. They are going to use the Geffen. They're going to use this Eitz HaDaat Tovara. Right? And again, why is the Geffen Eitz HaDaat Tovara? It's a tree that its fruit provides us with this feeling that we have great insight, great understanding, but there's a confusion going on between good and evil. As far as, you know, our parallel now between the four people who go into Paradise, understanding that Paradise is in fact Paradise, is Gan Eden, and seeing what takes place over here, what Chazal say, and again, this is more the Kabbalistic sources, what they try to delineate for us is this attempt by various generations and various individuals, and finally a group of people together who are setting out to try, as it were, to push God's hand and get to the point of a complete tikkun and get to the point of geula shlema. And we're not concluding it for today, but apparently we can't force God. Apparently we can't decide when the time is here, and apparently God does have a say in all of this. But the four people who go up, if you now realize that Ben Azai dies, one of the ramifications of eating from the tree of good, of knowledge of good and evil, what does it say will happen when you eat from the tree? Death will come into the world. So now, one of them dies. That's directly related to part of the problem. One of them, nitrafa da'ato. What does that mean, nitrafa da'ato? His da'at became affected. That's what happens when you eat from the Eitz HaDaat Tovara, that your da'at gets affected. It causes this total confusion. The third one, which says, Kitseitz b'netiot. What does Kitseitz b'netiot mean? It means he chopped down the tree. Chopped down the... What? Chopping down the tree is not good. Right? Chopping down the tree is a bad thing. It becomes... Not even worse... But by the way, the Midrash tells us that Adam HaRishon was Kitseitz b'netiot. It means heresy. If God, and this goes back to your observation, that what's the ultimate sin? God said, don't do it, and you do it. Which means God said, don't eat from this tree, and therefore it's really uprooting, pulling out the roots, getting rid of the foundation, rejecting the foundation, but that's part of what takes place at that point as well. Which means all sin really emanates from that point. And it says that only Rabbi Akiva is somebody who's able to be Olev B'Shalom and Yored B'Shalom. And by the way, part of the question is, why Rabbi Akiva succeeds and the others fail? And we have different approaches on this. The Maharsha quotes an old book. Let me just see. I know I have somebody over here someplace quoting the Maharsha, quoting an old book. Source 33. Toldot Yaakov Yosef. Toldot Yaakov Yosef is one of the first students of the Baal Shem Tov. One of the oldest Hasidic sources we have. I found in an old book.
Rabbi Akiva shegiyeh legvul shesechel enoshi yefsher lahagiyah elav amad below haras la'alot lamala. Yayin sham.
Which means that according to the Marsha, Rabbi Akiva did not go as far. Rabbi Akiva stopped, and the others went far further. In order to understand, and again, if we're a little bit familiar with some of these sources, there is a literature that talks about all of these travelings that take place, various rabbis going into heaven and different places of heaven and seeing different things. The one that you're most familiar with is from the prayers on Yom Kippur, when we talked about the ten martyrs, and then Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha says, he says the name of God, he goes off into heaven. So that's one kind of description like this. This is the way that Chazal described the four who go into paradise. They also go up into heaven. The problem is what happens when you open up the first gate of heaven and you look and you see things that you've never seen before. And then you go beyond that, you get to the second gate, and the third gate, and the fourth gate, and the fifth gate, and the sixth gate. Ben Azai, according to the mystical sources, got in trouble at the sixth gate. But when you get to this, what happens when you open a door and you see behind it colors that don't exist on this planet? There's all kinds of shade. You hear sounds that just don't exist. You see, there are smells that you just don't even begin to understand. And you go there and you say, why go back? Why return to this world? Why come back and pay my mortgage? Why come back and be involved in worldly things when there is this unbelievable world out there? And that, according to these sources, is part of the danger of going up in this kind of study. Not because you may fail, but you may succeed. And if you succeed, then you may fail. Because it could be that you're not whole enough to come back. Or, as Rabbi Akiva teaches us, according to the Maharsha, quoting from an old book, and if my recollection serves me, I believe it's from a book from Tordus Halevi Abulafia who explains this, that to have the religious and emotional maturity to say, I can't go any further. This is as far as I can go. I mean, we live in a generation where people don't really know their limits, where people don't really have a full appreciation, this is what my capabilities are, and I would be making a mistake if I go any further and try to take something upon myself. Generally, the question becomes, how much more will I get paid, and how much more prestige will I have, and that becomes the larger issue, rather than saying, you know, where can my capabilities be best used, or more so, am I overstepping my bounds? Rabbi Akiva gets to the point that he knows is the limit of human comprehension, which, by the way, lo yir'eini hadam v'chai. There is something which goes beyond the Adam. There is something which you can perceive. What's the problem? You can't return back to be an Adam. And that point is where Rabbi Akiva stops. See, it's very interesting that Nadav and Avihu, and I'll show you sources that go into this very, very clearly. What they do, they're young, they're not married, they don't have children, and I hate to speak in general terms, but sometimes being married and having children has an ability of grounding us and letting us see the world in a more realistic manner than people who are only by themselves, who then can think in the most ideal terms, and you don't have to think about something which is more grounded. If you let's take a look at yeah.
That they went in to do tikkun in Gan Eden, did they do it or not?
No.
So if they weren't korban, if the korban got accepted, then you know that the
well, let's wait and reserve judgment on that.
Okay.
let's look at source 22. Lukute Halachos, this is from ultimately these teachings go back to Rav Nachman of Breslov, written by Rav Nachman of Breslov's student. Ki olu lamala mala shelo berishut v'lo ratzu laharid atzman lamata lamshich hadat midor ludor. Which means they got, this is not Dvavi it's talking about, right, by the way, which you realize now is an exact parallel to what we just now read in the Marsha about Ben Azai, is that they got to this point of going further and further high. They didn't want to come down. V'chinat chalifot hanal, shezeu b'chinat begin de lo anasibu, because they were not married. Right? That's nisu'in in Aramaic. U'kemoshe katuvu bonim lo hayalahem, they didn't have children. Ki ikur ha-hit kashrut hanal, hu besod yichud ish ve'isha b'kdusha, shemisham hamshachat kol hadorot shehin ha-chalifut, v'heim savru sheyucholam la-haktir k'torat b'lo tikun, al-kein meitu. What he's pointing at, and he's not saying it clearly over here, he's saying is that something is missing over here, is that for some reason they are not able to be connected. What they are is they're lacking wives, they're lacking children, and they instead, on themselves, they go off on this expedition going in a place they shouldn't go. Let me point something out which is interesting, which I think will give us great perspective in why they would have done this. Aside from that we'll blame them for not being married and therefore there was nothing to ground them. When I read the source now in this context, you'll understand it, but I think you've all missed it till this point. In source number 9, it says, Vayikach Aaron et Elisha, Vayikach Aharon et Elisheva, bat Aminadav, achot Nachshon lo leisha, v'tev lo et Nadav et Aviu, et Elazar v'et Itamar. Aaron gets married. Who does he marry? He marries a nice Jewish girl named Elisheva. Who is Elisheva? Elisheva is the daughter of Aminadav, Achot Nachshon. Now this is very funny. Why should it tell us over here? It should have said, and Aaron married Elisheva, bat Aminadav. Any of you who know Aminadav will know that he also had a son. Why does it make a difference that he also had a son named Nachshon? So Rashi explains, Achot Nachshon, Mikan lamadnu hanosei isha tzarech levdok ba'acheh. But if anybody wants to marry a girl, they should take a look at the brothers. Why? Because it says achot nachshon. Why look at the brothers? For what purpose? I don't know. This is a little frightening. If anybody wants to marry my daughter Elisheva, we'll look at her brothers. I'm not so sure. That's much more than that. No. Nothing to do with Hebrew in this case. You marry a woman. You should look at her brothers. Why should you look at her brothers? Because it'll tell you something what your children will be like. So what can you tell me about Nachshon? What does Nachshon do? He jumps in when no one else is willing to jump, no one else is ready to go. He jumps in. So now what you tell me about Nadav and Avihu? They also jump in. Which means, you know, I was bothered by something. If you think for a second, Nadav and Avihu, they do something they're not supposed to do. Pinchas also does something they're not supposed to do. Because in both cases, they're not instructed to do it. Nadav and Avihu do what they're not instructed, and they die. Pinchas does what he's not supposed to do, and he becomes a Kohen. Right? How exactly do we have the ability of knowing when this is the proper thing to do, when it's not the proper thing to do, when you get rewarded, when you get punished. So it's interesting that what Nadav and Avihu do is they imitate Nachshon in a sense. This is their uncle. Look, if you want to dramatize it a little bit, you can imagine sitting around the campfire talking about, you know, the battles of old, and how when, you know, things are getting tough and the Egyptians are coming at them, no place to go, Nachshon is the guy, he takes initiative, he goes and he jumps in, but they're doing the same thing. And by the way, it's not so much time has gone by. They're doing the same thing. They're copying Nachshon. And again, I don't know if that's what Rashi had in mind over here. Rashi's explaining the verse, but this really does give us an incredible amount of insight when we realize that what they're doing is something which is very similar. As far as the... What's the matter? They go where they're not supposed to go. Let me explain to you... No, one second. What I think that you're saying is, Pinchas does what he does because there's a catastrophe taking place. Nachshon does what he does because they're about to be annihilated. They do what they do because they get carried away with the spirit of the moment, which is very different. Still, do they go where they're not supposed to go? Yes, there is a parallel to say that it's identical or not, which means there are those who said this is the problem of getting, you know, all carried away with religious, what's the word? Ecstasy. Fervor.
My problem, though, is that on her Sinai, they see Hashem and they hear everything's fine. Hashem doesn't want to ruin this great day and whatever. Hashem never reprimands them and says, but don't ever do that again or you're going to get it.
Unless you're dealing not with the punishment as much as with the result. Lo yirani adam v'chai, does it sound like a punishment?
I think, too, maybe it depends on the true intention. And only Hashem can really know what that person's true intention is.
Which goes back to the basic point, is this a sin or is this not a sin? And correct, God knows what the intention is. Are they committing a sin or are they not committing a sin? Did they do something which is wrong or did they do something which has a ramification to it? Which means most of the sources that deal with it say that they jumped into this, they went to this point that they couldn't come back. And it's a very similar thing, is that you see God. Yeah,
it's not. But if it's a direct result and not a punishment, then it is ruining, you know, our Sinai. Consistent.
You're asking me to be consistent. This is. So let me make a couple of observations about this. First of all, it's particularly appropriate this week when, aside from reading about the death of Nadab and Avihu, we also read Parshat Parah. And Parah ultimately is this antidote to death. The Parah Duma comes in order to, you know, to solve the problem of the Tuma, which takes place from death. The fact that they go inside with a Ketoret is something which hopefully all of you have heard me say so many times and too many times already. The fact that they walk in on the one hand, according to Chazal, drunk, and on the other hand they walk in with a Ketoret, are two things which directly lead us back to the sin that takes place by Gan Eden. Torah, of course, representing the sense of smell, which is the one place that was never corrupted. They go in armed with the Torah, but on the other hand, they go in with the Geffen, trying to create this kind of tikkun. The problem ultimately would seem to be is that they're just simply not ready to go there. And you know what? God can say this is a glorious day, this is a great day, the Mishkan is starting, but God can say, but we're not ready yet to get to the, we're not ready at this point to get to the end of history. It is interesting that according to Chazal, this connection between Nadav and Avihu and Pinchas is actually far greater. The Zohar tells us that when Pinchas is about to go and kill Zimri and Cozbi, it tells us that the souls of Nadav and Avihu, who have been flying about, who are very pure souls, according to the Zohar, very pure souls, they died because they couldn't be in this world anymore, they go and they fly into Pinchas, and Pinchas then over the years becomes Eliyahu, and then the Arizal said, whenever you say the prayer Anna Hashem Hoshiyana, God bring about salvation, Anna stands for Eliyahu Nadav and Avihu, and that this Anna stands for Eliyahu Nadav Avihu, that we're praying that bring about salvation. It's also very interesting that ultimately, Pinchas is the one, when Mashiach finally will come, Pinchas is the one who, excuse me, Eliyahu is the one who's going to be the Mivaser, the one who's going to tell us that the Messianic age is finally ready. It's also very interesting that on every Pesach, we fill up a Kos Shel Eliyahu, right, which talks about the Geula Krova, and therefore the wine that we're giving Eliyahu to use, how far may that be from this original Tikkun that Nadav and Avihu were trying to do, going all the way back to the wine which was used in Gan Eden. The problem with us starting late today, I don't know how long we're allowed to go before people start yelling at us, is that there was a lot more that we did not get to. Just to give a glimpse of some of it, it could be that included in the tikkun of Gan Eden, the tikkun of the Eitz Hadaat Tov Hara, is specifically around this problem of death. I mean, when it comes to confusion, which eating from the Eitz Hadaat gives us, there's nothing which confuses us and torments us as much as death. Which means the end of life Sadik Baralo is something which we have a great difficulty with. Even Moshe Rabbeinu, we're told, was somebody who grapples with this idea. When you will realize that Sadik Baralo may be part of this idea of looking at God. Now, the reason why I'm connecting these things, which may not be clear to you. The Gemara tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu asked God to show him certain things. After they were forgiven for the Chet HaEgel, he says, let me see you, which goes back to the point, let me see your face, which goes back to the point that Moshe didn't want to look at one point. Hashem says they don't want to look there, and that's it, you can't look now. Which means, was it right for Moshe not looking? Which means, is looking at God the wrong thing, or looking at God when you're not ready is the wrong thing? Which goes back to another point. When I told you that according to the Marsha, Rabbi Akiva just didn't go as far, that's not the way the Zohar understands it. The Zohar understands that why do Ben Azai and Ben Zoma and Lisha Ben Avuya, why do they all mess up? Because they didn't go as far as Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva went further. And when you don't go as far, you see things superficially. When you look at stones of pure marble, and you look at it superficially, what will you see on these pure marble stones? It'll look like water. When you get to the stones of pure marble, don't say word to word. Don't look at it superficially. Make sure you don't stop before you go deep enough into it. According to the Zohar's approach, Rabbi Akiva goes much further than the others, and that's why he comes out okay. And if you start a process, you need to finish it correctly. According to this idea, when Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't look at the snare, and he comes back to God and he says, let me see. God says, no, you don't want to look then. I'm not going to show you now. But God then says something very interesting to him. He goes, I won't show you the front, but I'll show you the back. Now, it's not clear from the Gemara if ultimately God revealed to Moshe the secret of Tzadik Baralo, or he didn't. The Gemara, different opinions of whether he did or he didn't. So let me at least explain this with a metaphor, and with this we'll stop for today. When it says that he showed him the back and he wouldn't show him the front, we, of course, read that every week in Shul on Shabbos. When do we read that? In Anz Mirot, and what do we say? Kesher Tfilin Hera La'anav. Right? He showed him his back. So the Gemara is using this wonderful anthropomorphism that if he saw his back, what would he have seen? He would have seen God Kesher Shel Tfilin. Again, as I said, it's an anthropomorphism that presumably if you looked at a tzaddik, you look at a Talmud Chacham, what would you see if you saw his back? You'd see the back of his tefillin. So when he showed him his back, he showed him the Kesher Shel Tefillin. By showing him this, does he reveal to him the secret? Does he now realize and understand everything? Or not necessarily? So if you saw the tefillin from the front, you have a type of an illusion. You have the tefillin Sharosh, which is in the middle. Then you have the straps on one side and the straps on the other side. According to Kabbalistic literature, the straps on one side represent Midat Hadin, and the other side represent Midat HaRachamim. You look at the front, and what do you see? You see Midat Hadin, you see Midat Rachamim, and what does it look like? It looks like it comes from two different places. So sometimes God comes and uses Midat Hadin, and sometimes God uses Midat HaRachamim, and we get very confused because we don't know how to deal with this. We think that God is, you know, manic depressive, or God is psychotic and just completely inconsistent. But what happens when God shows us the back? When you see the back, you realize that both of them come from the same place, and that's the Kesher Shel Tefillin. The Kesher Shel Tefillin becomes this idea of Teferet, this idea that the two of them, both sides, Din and Rachamim, come from the exact same place. And according to Tzaduk, that place is right next to the place of the spine. It's right near the place of the spine, which is called Luz. The Luz is the place where Tchiyat HaMetim will come from, which means even though we deal with the world where there is death, where there is this ramification of the sin of the Eitz Hadat, whereby now death has come into the world and we have this terrible confusion, that the terrible confusion comes because we don't see the back. And therefore, by showing Moshe the back, he actually showed him this incredible unity when it comes to God, but he ultimately showed him also this point of the Luz and this point where we are able to really get to this tikkun of the chait of Adam and get to this point where there's no more death in the world, and more than that, all those who one day had died will one day come back and to get to the point of the ultimate tikkun, the ultimate point of Tchiyat HaMetim, which means what Moshe is able to see by seeing the back according to this approach is something which no one else saw. But Moshe was somebody who was more involved in this world. And there's one last point that I'll throw out. What Moshe does is he says to Aaron, he gives him this strange answer and then says, "Vayidom Aaron." Aaron doesn't speak. Aaron is silent. Aaron's silence is understood as he accepts. He accepts. It's interesting that when Moshe, and this is Gemara we also learned a couple years ago, when Moshe sees the death of Rabbi Akiva, when he goes in the future, what does Hashem say? He starts questioning. Sadik v'ralo? How could it? And what does God say to God? Says himself. And therefore what God is telling Moshe to do is exactly what Moshe tells Aaron to do to get to this point of Vayidom Aaron. Rav Nachman of Breslov goes into this idea of shtika, of accepting, of understanding, that sometimes when you speak you can't understand, and sometimes when you're silent you can understand much more than when you speak. But ultimately, I mean hopefully, that when we combine these parshiot together this week, on the one hand, read about this terrible death, and we realize that what they were trying to do is to go all the way back to Gan Eden. But then at the same time this week, because of the leap year, because of this funny year, we also read about the Parah Aduma, which brings about Tahara, and is the antidote to death. So hopefully combining together to read about the Parah Aduma, together with reading about Nadav Avihu, that hopefully we'll get to the point of a complete tikkun, and we'll get to the point where death will be no more, and that the luz, which is connected to the keshel tefillin, that we see everything, that it's really complete unity, we'll get to this point of tchiyat hametim as well. Shabbat shalom.
It's not just that they brought wine, but they drank wine. Some years ago,